quantum Zeno effect and saw that just by resetting the qubit, not doing anything, not measuring it, just resetting it, if you reset it fast enough, you got the, you could retain an arbitrary state. Okay? And it works, yes?
It just depends on the state. Because the closer it is to one of the plus or minus states, the better it seems that there's the more the fidelity is higher, because the one which is the equal to a position of plus and minus, that state doesn't really change.
Right. So yes. I mean, one way of preserving a state is to make the state commute with your noise model. In which case, don't bother to do anything. So you can just stay home, and the state will stay there anyways. So yeah, that always you see. But and that's of course why we report things in fidelities, right? So that we ask for any arbitrary state, what would we see? Yeah. Then you could say, well, why do we hesitate about doing this experiment, right? See, it seems like a nice thing. We could show something, and it's a pretty good way of doing error correction if you have the resources to continually reset the system. And the reason that we hesitate is that when we go back and we reset the electron spin, right, we only get that right with a certain probability. And so if you took your same model and you said that you were going to reset your electron spin, but you only got it right 99% of the time, easy addition to put in your model, you would see that this fidelity comes crashing down pretty quickly. And so there's an additional term there that we need to consider before we make that practical, which is to say, hey, we gave you a resource. We told you in the problem that you had this resource that you could perfectly reset the electron spin. And now, as an experimentalist, we have to put that with some reality of what we can actually reset the electron spin. So we're still considering it. And if you guys want to come by some time and talk about things like that in more detail, it's fun to do. Though Osama is at MIT this week, so we're going to talk about his project. It's nice to have him in the room. What I want to do today is first go over what I went over yesterday with a slightly different language, okay? Because I wasn't so happy with that. I want to make sure you actually get the point. And then we'll continue to look at quantum repeaters. Okay, so what we were looking at yesterday was the Karper cell cycle. And the Karper cell cycle takes the Ramsey fringe and it puts a series of pi pulses in the Ramsey fringe. And let me just leave it there. It goes on forever. So this is, I'm going to label them this way today. Yesterday I labeled this as tau over 4, so cycle time was tau. You'll see why I want to label it this way today for a little bit different analysis. And everything is going to be about the y-axis. All right. And we say that we have a Hamiltonian, which is the Hamiltonian for the noise, which is omega noise sigma z, right? We're only looking at a one qubit dynamics. And we're going to give some probability distribution. Yeah, that's okay. So there's omega n, some probability of omega n. And there's some width, which I'll call capital omega. Okay, yeah?
Is the last tau supposed to be true tau?
No. Thank you for the question. So I think about this as this cycle. Yeah? So you're exactly right, that it's two tau to the next pi pulse. But the cycle that we're going to analyze is this one. Okay, so we have this probability distribution. And what we're going to see is that following this first pulse, the system will have some response. And so if I plotted here this piece as the expectation value of sigma x, remember in the Ramsey experiment, normally one would put another pi over 2 pulse here and measure the expectation value of sigma z. But you know, we can rotate our measurement operator. So we'll just look at the expectation value of sigma x, and we won't bother about it. And we'll have some decay here as a function of time. And this decay is characterized by what we call T2 star. And it is just the Fourier transform of this. Okay, so this decay is the Fourier transform of this probability distribution. Now notice I center the probability distribution about zero, because you know, if it's not about zero, then there's no big deal. I can just take that piece and put it into the interaction frame that I'm interested in, right? So the only part I care about is the part that goes away from, that's not centered about zero. And what does this say? It says that every time I make a measurement, so every time I make a measurement might be that I run this experiment a million times to build up an expectation value, I get a random value of omega n. Or it could be that I have a million systems that I'm looking at in parallel, and if I looked over that distribution, I would see that omega n has a random value. Okay? So all this says is that there's a random quantity there. And notice that although we characterize this by T2 star, there's no reason for this to be exponential. This is whatever that shape is. And this shape is given by something in our instrument. Okay? So that is just a given, that's just whatever we've engineered in. Now this piece is describing the static. This is describing the width of the noise distribution. And now I want to introduce another probability distribution. And the probability here is the probability of changing the frequency as a function at a given over a time period, right? And so now I can plot out, let me use the same parameter, same values I use here. So now I'm going to say that the noise frequency isn't constant in time. It varies. And it varies by this kernel. So if I asked, well, what happened to this isochromat at some later time? Then we say, oh, well, it's spread by this. And so it gets mapped to that range. Okay? And so here I want to instead of, you know, yesterday I introduced this fictitious variable z that I integrated over. I'm just going to remove that fictitious variable. We'll do everything directly in frequency space. Okay, so now then I have this conditional displacement probability. Okay, so it's a conditional displacement probability in frequency. And this is just a probability of frequency. And what do we want? We want that capital omega is much, much broader than small omega, small delta omega. If I do that, then I ask, well, how does this affect it? It's very easy. I can describe that by a convolution. If I can describe things by a convolution, then I can come up with a general answer. Of course, if I can't describe it by a convolution, and I have to explicitly integrate over a specific distribution, we can do that too, but we won't get to a universal answer. And this is the range that's physically interesting. Okay? So you got that. Here we say, this is the distribution of noises that we could see. And if we looked at the noise in an instant in time, this is how it varies as we look later on in time. Yep.
So each of the second distribution depends on t.
Yeah.
So
that's
for
exactly
each t,
right.
It's different.
Yes. So, you know, what we're going to say here is that delta omega is equal to the square root of 2dt, just as you would with any Gaussian probability, right? So here we're saying, the noise is random, we have a lot of random events, and so we're going to describe this by a Gaussian probability. And if we describe it by a Gaussian probability, then we can always associate a diffusion coefficient with the Gaussian effect. And the diffusion coefficient says that we're changing the frequency as a function of time, right? So the diffusion coefficient has units of delta omega squared per second. Okay? And so if I waited, you know, a little bit longer, this would get broader and broader and broader. So it gets broader as the square root of time. Okay. And since we have this defined as a probability, as a Gaussian, sorry, we just explicitly write it out. Okay. So we have explicitly our Gaussian, and everything's defined. Now, what I want to see is the influence at the time that we get these echoes, right? So we have one echo here, and we have another echo here. Okay, remember what happens is that with these pi pulses, if this was a delta function, so that there was no motion, then these echoes would come with the same intensity that we had here, neglecting the spin, the T1 effect in the problem, right? The T2, there would be no additional contribution from T2. So now we're going to do exactly the same thing that we did before. We're going to take the evolution of the system, right? I take this noise. We know that we started off here in a state that is along z. We rotated about y. And so during this time, we're always looking at the expectation values of sigma x. And the expectation value of sigma x under this noise Hamiltonian is simply a phase factor, right? And so we end up having a phase rotation of the system. And during that time, right, we're going to convolve with this probability of displacement in omega sub n. All right? So we're still looking at this piece. I keep doing that. We still have this piece, yeah? So it's exactly the same as before. And again, we take the Fourier transform of this. And so I'm going to take the Fourier transform of both of these with respect to time. This is a piece I want to understand. And I'm interested in what happens for the particular time tau here. Right? So I'm going to take, I want to see the dependence on time here. Yeah. So we take the Fourier transform, and I'm going to choose this as the variable that I am going to integrate over. So we're going to integrate over omega. So I can say, this thing looks like functionally omega, and this piece looks like functionally omega, because when I write it as a convolution integral, I no longer keep delta omega. I'm convoluting over omega. Yeah?
So this is a convolution. Where is this factor appearing? In what quantity? I mean, is it...
So this is describing the evolution of the spin, right?
Oh,
so
if I ask, this is the phase
factor? What happens... Yes.
For the state.
Right
here.
Okay. Right? So if I wrote down the expectation value of sigma x integrated over this distribution with this dynamic, that's the result. Right? This is one isochromat of this piece, and then we're here we are. So now we take the Fourier transforms of these, and so I get the delta function at t minus tau. Wiener-Kitchen says that the convolution turns to multiplication. Here we get the Gaussian, the Fourier transform of the Gaussian is a Gaussian, and this is minus t squared delta omega squared over 2. We sample this at tau, so we get the term that looks like minus tau squared delta omega squared over 2. Okay, so what does this tell us? It says that in the case that omega n is constant, when I look at a particular point here, okay, and I allow it to be broadened in time, but this evolution is fixed, then I see an attenuation of the expectation value of sigma x that goes as tau squared delta omega squared divided by 2. And we rewrite this, of course, to e to the minus tau squared dt. Right. Now, at this particular point, t is also tau. Right. That's a point we've looked at. But just like we did last time, I want to integrate the effect of this. So I want to integrate what happens as we're evolving here. And so this is for one particular isochromat. We integrate over all the isochromats, and we find sigma x, the expectation value, as a function of tau and t is equal to e to the minus tau squared dt over 3. All right, so there's the same result that we had last time. Now, this piece I want to rewrite, because, of course, the expectation value that we're describing here is that at these points here, right? It's not the expectation value in between. In fact, the expectation value in between probably goes to 0, right? All we're saying is at the moment that we're refocusing, we would see this piece of it. And why is that the right answer? Because what we're what we're calculating here is to say that we have some random event which is effectively taking away information. The information is that I have a perfect correspondence between the noise and the phase. Right? If the noise is constant and then I can measure the phase at every time, then I know what the noise is. It's simply the Fourier transform of that. By allowing the noise to move around, I lose that correspondence between the phase and the value of the noise. And that's what the decoherence is this loss of information. And that's what we're measuring here. We're measuring that loss of information. So it's only applicable at these points. And so then we know that T, we need to replace that with n times. I'm going to make it n times 4 tau because it's nicer just to look at the second echoes. That's a small point. It doesn't change any analysis. So then what we end up with is that sigma x as a function of tau in n is equal to e to the minus tau cubed d 4/3 n. Yeah? So now this piece here is exponential in n, right? N is the number of the echoes, echo number. And there's effective relaxation time there. It says that T2 effective for the CP map is equal to three-fourths divided by tau cubed times d. Okay? And so you see the desired feature here, that if I push these tau spacings closer and closer and closer and closer together, okay, that T2 becomes very long. Right? So we have a very strong sensitivity of the effective relaxation time as I make tau spacing short. We're sampling it faster and faster and faster. And if we sample it fast enough, then of course this piece here is narrow, and we lose very little information about the distribution. Yeah? Yes, please.
So what does CP stand for?
Carcasson.
Oh, okay. And what did you do up there? Did you convolve and then take the Fourier transform?
So what I did was I said that instead of doing the convolution integral, I'll take the Fourier transform, and so then I can multiply in reciprocal space.
Okay.
And after I do that, what I end up with is just a real number. So I don't need to go back to time. Because it's just a real number, the Fourier transform of real numbers, just a real number. Right? So that's just to allow a more compact description. Yeah? Yes, please.
Just to get this straight, there where you have sigma x is a function of tau and t.
Yeah.
You mean the expectation value is a function of tau and t.
That's exactly right. Yes. Okay, so here we have worked out this averaging or decoupling, right? So sometimes this is called averaging, refocusing, decoupling. That allows us to suppress variations in the noise. So what happened? The Hahn echo, just having one pi pulse, that's allowed us to suppress a variation in the noise. So if we have a static variation in noise, that's easy. We just need one echo, and we can suppress that. And we can, if the distribution is perfectly static in time, we can suppress that for all times. Life is easy. If there's a time dependence to the distribution of noise, then of course we have to put that time dependence, we have to compete with that time dependence in our refocusing scheme. But we can compete with it very effectively. Right? That all that's required is that effectively this piece here times tau be about 1. Okay, and then we can effectively remove it. Yeah?
Yeah, I'm just trying to understand, if sigma x goes to 0, then what has happened to us?
Thank you.
Maximally mixed or what?
No, because it's the expectation value. Right? So let's look at that again. So we're going to go back to this picture by Hahn that says that we're just looking in the transverse plane, and we started off with the state being directed along the x-axis. Okay, that's what this first pulse did. But remember that they were looking for an expectation value, so we need to have an ensemble. So here we say, oh, well, this isn't one spin. You know, this is 10 to the 6 spins. So there's lots of little vectors there. And then we allow the system to evolve in time. And forget about this for a second. The first thing it sees is that it has all of these different frequency components, right? And so it's going to fan out. And since it's centered about 0, it really will just fan out. And so you'll have a broad range of those. And of course, what do we mean by it goes to 0? It means that it's fanned out so that it occupies the xy plane uniformly. Yeah. And then what Hahn would say is, well, you give a pi pulse to the y-axis, so we essentially flip this plane over, and if the spins are moving in the same direction here and here, right, if this distribution hasn't changed, well, then because we flip the plane over, they'll all come back to the same place and we'll get the next. Okay, so the fact that we see this piece here simply says that we have a distribution of those. Okay. And then, of course, the piece that we care about, this is too easy to deal with. Right? That's all we had. We would have fun computers already. This piece is a hard part. And it says that, as you leave the system alone, more interesting things are happening. And that's what's driving the interesting dynamics. So, you know, the other way of thinking about this is, imagine I take that first plot and I'll plot omega in here on this axis, and then at each of these locations I'll put an xy plane. Right, so omega n is changing over this. And it says, well, okay, for some point omega n is equal to 0, and the spins stay there. Up above here, omega n is positive, and so the spins would have rotated. And here they would have rotated further, and here they would have rotated in the opposite direction. Right? And you can see that this is a nice picture because it shows that there's a correspondence. That if I just did this, I could take this phase angle here, phi, and I could make a plot of omega n versus phi. And at this point, phi is 0, and above it it's positive, and below it it's negative. And then you would say, okay, there's no information lost in this. This is why we don't call this decoherence. We haven't lost any information. Okay? And then, of course, if there's a random motion, well, what the random motion does is it starts to blur along this axis. We start to lose the information. And you can see, if the phase is changing slowly and we're blurring a little bit, it makes no bloody difference. But if the phase is changing fast, or if we make this broad, then it does make a difference, right? And so that's where the interplay
between tau and delta omega comes in this piece. Yeah? And so, in truth, you know, it might be that equation is the one that has the most physics. Although an experimentalist likes this one because it's related to the measurement, right? But this one tells you really what you need to know for the physics. It says you've chosen a time that you're modulating over. These pi pulses are a modulation. And you're comparing that to some dynamical process. It says, hey, can you modulate faster than the dynamical process? If you can, then you can remove the dynamical process. If you modulate slower than the dynamical process, then the dynamical process remains. And it's a fairly sharp transition. Okay. Is it clear now? Is it clearer than yesterday? No. Okay. I want to... one thing, go and take the next step. So what we have here is simply a way of removing noise. We haven't said what the noise is. Okay? So let's look at that. So now let's just take our qubit as a spin. We've been talking about NB centers, and the qubit in the NB center is a spin. Usually people think about it as an electron spin. So here we have an electron spin. That's a qubit. And for the discussion I want right now, I'm going to take this as a spin 1/2 particle. I want to do that because if I have a spin 1/2 particle, the only dynamic that a spin 1/2 particle sees is a magnetic-magnetic interaction. Right? It's a magnetic dipole, so the only interactions of a magnetic dipole is a magnetic-magnetic interaction. So then it's very easy to say, well, what is omega n? Omega n is the interaction with other magnetic fields. And the only piece of the other magnetic fields I care about is this time-dependent piece. Now, in the lab, you know, we find that we have a distribution of these things because there's some I-beam somewhere that someone welded, and it leads to a distorted magnetic field. So there's plenty of this. But this, again, is so easy to move, I don't care about it. I care about this piece. I will care about the time-dependent piece. And the time-dependent piece, it could be a truck going by on the street. That's a nice time dependence. But that's really slow, so this is really narrow. And so I don't care about it. The only thing I care about is what's happening locally. So out here, we have a bunch of other spins. And in the diamond NB center, also in quantum dots, these are nuclear spins. And then we have a set of interactions. We have our system. So we have the system Hamiltonian, which is the electron spin. So the total Hamiltonian. Plus we have the nuclear Hamiltonian. So we'll call it the environment. So that's the nuclear spins. We'll look at that in a second. Plus we have a coupling between them. Which is a hyperfine interaction. So that we've already seen. But now we'll take a real simple model for the hyperfine interaction. We'll take this to be the sum over I of sigma z electron, sigma z nuclear spin, and some prefactor. Okay? So there's one electron spin, there's multiple nuclear spins, and we'll take a really nice model that says that we have a sigma z interaction. Why do I want that nice model? Because the Hamiltonian for the noise that we looked at over here was a sigma z term, right? So I want the electron to evolve as a sigma z term. And what's the noise? Omega n is equal to the sum over I of j sub I sigma z n sub I. It had to be an I there, sorry. Right? So this is our noise. So the electron's sitting there, and it sees a bunch of nuclear spins. And the nuclear spins have some states. They have some effectively dipole coupling between those. And so we add up all those dipole moments, and that's the noise that the electron spin sees. Okay. The environment noise. Now, the environment noise says that the nuclear spins have to change state, right? So for the nuclear spins, we have a Hamiltonian, which is sigma sub I omega z sub I sigma z nuclear sub I. Right, this is just a Zeeman Hamiltonian to say, oh yeah, there's some quantization axis they like to be aligned with it. And this term by itself can lead to noise if there's a T1 process, right? If there's a relaxation process, what does the T1 tell us? The T1 tells us the time scale under which a nuclear spin will flip. Okay? So here we could have noise from a T1 process of the nuclear spin flipping, but the lifetime of nuclear spins is typically so long compared to electron spins that we can forget about it. So this just gives a quantization axis. No fluctuation in noise, no effect. And then we get to a term which is an interaction between the nuclear spins. And it's a term that we've seen before, this dipolar term. That says, if I have two nuclear spins, they can both flip. If they both flip, you know, if I have this one down and that one up, and then they flip. Well, the hyperfine coupling between this one, these two, and the hyperfine coupling between those two is different. So by this flip-flop process, then there's a variation in the field here. Okay? And so then there's this dynamic, and you say, well, what's the time scale for a nuclear spin to flip? Well, this dipolar coupling frequency here, let me just call it omega. We don't need my jargon. This frequency here, this is big. So this can happen quickly. Okay? And that's a source of decoherence. The other problem with the dipolar interaction, the other reality of the dipolar interaction, is that this frequency goes as 1 over r cubed, of course. It's just a dipolar interaction, so dipole-dipole energy. And 1 over r cubed, you integrate that, and it's logarithmically divergent, or conditionally convergent, depending upon, you know, what language you like. And so I say, I look at the spins that are, you know, within 2 angstroms. But the spins that are from 1 nanometer to 2 nanometer are just as important as the ones between the first angstrom. Right? As are the ones between the first meter and the second meter. Yeah? So there's a lot of spins you have to worry about. Okay. Our samples usually are not a meter in size, so we don't go out quite that far. But you know, it does have this logarithmic scale to it, and so it says, hey, this fluctuation can be very important. Okay. So now then, what I'd like to do is to take this effective Hamiltonian, and by decoupling, I want to limit it to that. Right? That's the goal of quantum computing, is to say, take all of this stuff away and leave us here. This is the good stuff. There's three approaches to that. One approach to that is to say, let's modulate this electron spin. Right? So I can take this Karp-Russell sequence and I can run it on the electron spin, apply the Planck pulses to the electron spin. If I do that, then I know what I have to do. I have to do this fast compared to what looks like delta omega over here. Okay? And which is coming from this term, this nuclear term is leading to that. And of course, if I do that, what the Karp-Russell sequence does is it saves one phase, right? So it doesn't save a whole qubit, unfortunately, but it does save a phase. And so that's the first thing. Approach one says run the Karp-Russell sequence on the electron spin. And if we run it fast, really fast, we can compete with this term. The second thing that we can do, and of course what we're doing there is exactly we're suppressing this noise, right? So when I run the Karp-Russell sequence on the electron spin, I don't actually change this, the environment piece of the Hamiltonian, right? The time average of this piece is going to be just the same, right? Because it's only nuclear-nuclear interactions. We haven't modulated them at all. The piece that goes to zero is this piece, right? The coupling term. So this attacks the coupling term. And directly, you can see that. All you need to do is go into the interaction frame of this Hamiltonian here, based upon this sequence, and then calculate the time average Hamiltonian, and that term will go to zero. Two, we can apply the Karp-Russell sequence on the nuclear spins. We apply the time, the averaging on the nuclear spins, then this term will again go to zero, right? The coupling term goes to zero again. So it still takes H coupling to zero. It actually does change the dipolar term. I'm not going to convince you of that, but it takes this environment term and it takes it to minus one half of the environment coupling. This piece, of course, goes to zero. This piece goes to minus one half. It's not so hard to see, but I won't spend the time to show it to you. And, of course, it leaves the electron alone. So if this was the only source of noise for the electron spin, then the electron spin would be perfect. But that's a big if. If only noise, then the electron is perfect. All right. Three. Yeah, please.
On the nuclear spins, do you have to target each nuclear spin individually, or can you, like...
That's a great question. So what you want to do is to arrange that as you modulate the nuclear spins, you can modulate them all at the same time so that you suppress any differences in the nuclear spins. And if you look at the success of applying the methods, how successful you are depends on how well you achieve that goal. So You know, it is a problem that the nuclear spin that's close to the electron spin sees the electron spin, right? So it's a bit different than the one that's out here, because the electron hyperfine nuclear hyperfine interaction decays with distance, and so it becomes difficult to do the whole thing. But it's a figure for error to work with. Yeah. All right. The third way of doing this is to polarize the nuclear spins. So, just as you were saying at the homework assignment, take the nuclear spins and put them in an eigenstate of the noise, and everything will be stationary. Right? In other words, if I have all the nuclear spins polarized, then that is an eigenstate of this. And now the coupling is still there, but there's no fluctuations because we're in an eigenstate of the piece that was causing the fluctuations. So by polarizing the nuclear spins, we remove the fluctuations. And that's a really nice thing, because if I remove the fluctuations, then I can still run the Carpuccell sequence, but I can run it really slowly, right? I don't have to do anything fast, because now I no longer have this piece of distribution. I only have that one. Okay? And many, many people, us included, are trying to do this. But you can see what happens. You know, you have a sample. It's got 10 to the 14 nuclear spins sitting in there. And you get 10 to the 13 of them polarized. But that leaves you most of your spins, right? 90% of your spins are not polarized. And you've done a great job, right? You've increased the polarization typically by a factor of 10 to the 5. You think, oh, done 10 to the 5. Life is really good. And you can write lots of PRLs, but you're still a long way away from removing this effect. So it's a great idea, but it's not been achieved experimentally. And so the last thing to do then is to say, okay, here's a way of removing the fluctuations. Removing the fluctuations is a really great idea. Let's remove the fluctuations right here. Let's take that term and force it to zero. Now, when this was originally suggested, it was suggested by some Russians. The community as a whole immediately came back and told them they were idiots. And they said, look, you've got this dipolar Hamiltonian that looks like sigma dot sigma minus 3 sigma z sigma z. And they said, that's isotropic. You can't modulate it. So you're bloody out of luck that this term is always going to be there. And that was the state for quite a while. Unfortunately, the Russians didn't come with a very clear picture of how they thought one could do this, and the experimentalists weren't listening anyways. And then a very creative experimentalist, John Waugh, was building a new spectrometer in his lab, and he didn't know how to do the electronics. So he got a friend in who was a really good electronics engineer. And this guy was building his system for putting pulses out. And the engineer knew nothing about NMR or physics. And so he just ran a series of pulses. He just gave lots of pulses of RF. And whenever he gave a burst of RF, he would see an echo. And the echo shouldn't have been there. You know, we have this nice idea that shows up with these particular timings. I mean, just give a burst of RF and you get an echo. And he left the sheet of paper with John. So the engineer was working the weekends, and John was divorced, had two small kids. He was working a few hours during the week. He leaves this piece of paper, says, oh, the electronics works. here's the proof, you know, there's the sequence, there's the signal. And John says, well, you know, it's not working. The signal shouldn't be there. What are you doing? So they went back and forth a few times. And finally, the engineer convinced John that actually the signal was there. And John and his students figured out why it should be there. And so let me show you not the sequence that they were looking at, but let me show you a different sequence. Which shows the effect more clearly. And this is my long-winded way for these last 2 days of getting to your question, beginning of class yesterday, of let's look at an interaction frame that's more interesting. Okay, so here's the sequence. The first thing I want you to notice about the sequence is that if I define a toggling frame based upon the radio frequency pulses, it goes to the identity, right? That the unitary for these pulses over this cycle is equal to the identity, right? This pi over 2 pulse about the minus y-axis cancels that pi pulse about the y-axis, and this minus x cancels that x, and so everything's good. Says that. Yep, u is equal to the identity. But of course, we didn't look at what happens to this Hamiltonian under that sequence. We just said if there was nothing else going on. So now then we take this Hamiltonian, and we're going to look at it in the reference frame of these pulses. So now we go into this toggling frame, and I say, let me just take the two terms separately. We'll take sigma dot sigma, and we'll go into the interaction frame given by these pulses. And this goes to sigma dot sigma, it goes to sigma dot sigma, right? Isotropic is isotropic, nothing happens. Okay, boring. But, you've got to put it down anyways. Then we take this sigma z piece and look at the toggling frame transformations. Well, here it's sigma z, sigma z. Here, it's been acted on by an x pulse, so it's sigma y, sigma y. Now remember, I'm taking this frame in each of these intervals back to this one. Okay? That's the way we're doing this. We're defining an interaction frame, which always takes them back. So then here, if I want to know how it transforms sigma z, sigma z, I have to sandwich it first by the y pulse, so I get sigma x, and then the x pulse does nothing to that. So in this window, the interaction frame transform is sigma x, sigma x. You have to go this way because we want to get into one frame that we can add everything up in. Okay. So this one, well, we have the sigma y pulse, but then it's going to be canceled by that sigma y pulse, so it's exactly the same as this state. That's sigma y, sigma y. And here's sigma z, sigma z. So now then, we add up this. I want to take the average of this. So sigma z, the average over this time is, well, we've got 6 tau. So it's 1 over 6 tau. For a time 2 tau, it's 2 tau sigma z plus 2 tau sigma y plus 2 tau sigma x. So it's equal to 1/3 sigma dot sigma. And now you're really happy, right? Because I come over to a dipolar interaction. I say, oh, well, what's the average dipolar interaction over the cycle? Well, this one didn't change, right? So it's still proportional to sigma dot sigma. But this one did change. It went to 1/3 of sigma dot sigma. So it's minus sigma dot sigma is equal to 0. And that was really surprising in the field. That was surprising because people imagined that any time that you have these mutual spin flips, you've irrevocably lost information. In fact, if you look at the early literature, that was the description, that you had what was so-called a homogeneous line shape, so that there was no information. It was not possible to correlate the system. And people at that time really did believe that decoherence was an event that was microscopic in time, that if I was looking at the loss of information, I could say that at every instant I would lose information, and at each instant it's not recoverable. Now that's, of course, you know, doesn't correspond to the physics over here, right? The physics says, hey, we got it because we had a Hamiltonian. And if we describe something by a Hamiltonian, then if we can reach in the right way, we can recover that information. Yeah? And that's what happens here, is that we reach in and modulate the dynamics of the nuclear spins in the right way. In this case, we simply turn off this Hamiltonian. In other cases, which I won't show you, I can cause the average Hamiltonian to be minus one of this Hamiltonian. So I can actually just run the whole thing in reverse. And we nicely see an echo. And it's an echo of a multi-body effect. Okay, so all of that is nice. So this sequence was invented by John Waugh, Ehrlich Haeberlin, and Huber. And so it goes by the bad acronym of Wahoo-ha. But that's John's sense of humor. And it works great. Now you can notice that what I've described here is in fact this zero order term that we talked about in the Magnus expansion. And the higher order terms are not zero. It turns out that the first order term for many pieces is zero, that the symmetry of this drives that term to zero. But the second order term is not zero, and you have to go to much more elaborate sequences to make all of these terms of the Magnus expansion zero, but we know how to do that. And so that's all worked out. But this shows you the piece. So here's why I like having this interaction frame representation. I can take what is really a very complicated dynamics, and if I just integrated this, I wouldn't see this refocusing effect. I wouldn't see it if I just integrated it, because it only shows up in zeroth order. The second order term would be a drag if I integrated it. I would get a big effect, and I wouldn't know that I was seeing an echo. And it gives me a nice intuition about what's going on. Okay, I know exactly why I lost. I could take this term to zero. I know exactly why the Russians were right, right? That even though the Hamiltonian includes a piece that is isotropic, you know, the fact that one piece of the Hamiltonian is isotropic doesn't prevent us from modulating that Hamiltonian. Okay? Good. So then, if we ran that sequence, we remove this term, we still need the Karp-Russell sequence, but everything works well. And I don't have to polarize the sample. So those are the ways of getting control. And I had thought that we would get to the quantum repeater today, but we'll do that tomorrow. Okay? Any questions?